Thank you.
We'll hear argument next in J v. Global Foundries, 18861.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray, for the gracious time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Take nothing from the fact that the room is totally cleared out.
Didn't want to mention that, Your Honor.
Mr. Manley, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ryan Manley. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter, a construction worker named Michael J. Your Honors, the district court in this case erred in dismissing plaintiff's labor law 240 claim by deciding that he was injured in a kinetic energy related accident instead of a gravity related one.
Well, but it's not, the statute is not about gravity or kinetic energy, right? It's about elevated workplaces. Isn't that what it's about?
It's about elevated workplaces, Your Honor, but it's also about workers that are injured due to the inherent effects of gravity on an
object. If I drop a toolbox on my foot on the ground, not up on a height, then that's covered by the statute.
I don't believe that would be
gravity. It's gravity.
But we're talking, in that hypothetical, Your Honor, you're talking about a toolbox. You're not talking about a massively heavy piece of construction material.
I don't think there's anything in the statute that said it has to be a massively heavy construction material, does it?
Well, I think that, you know, the case law is interpreted as, you know, the object has to have sufficient force and be of a sufficient weight as to where the elevation is de minimis, and that because of that, if it weighs so much, it can cause damage to someone's person.
Yeah, this all takes place in a flatbed truck, which is about, 2.5 feet off the ground, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so, doesn't the case law, isn't it in fact referred to as well-established case law, that the surface of a flatbed truck is not an elevated work surface for purposes of the statute?
Only for purposes of falling worker cases, Judge. There is, in fact, a case, the Bernard case, in which summary judgment for defendant was reversed on the labor law 240 claim, where a worker was standing in the back of a flatbed truck and was injured by a beam that came down and struck him being raised by a crane.
Yeah, well, the beam was at an elevated height, right?
That's correct.
And that's the nature of that accident, was that the injury was sustained because it was an elevated work site. But there's nothing about this that involves an elevated work site, is there?
Well, Judge, I would argue that the piece of metal itself being 5 foot tall and having to be the maneuver in which it had to be lifted into the truck due to the absence of an available safety device, it had to go above the plaintiff's head and then come down. And in that case, you know, gravity acted upon the object and actually brought it down from a higher elevation to the lower elevation where the plaintiff was standing. That was the only way they could get this.
If I have to lift a toolbox over a fence and the toolbox drops and hits somebody on the foot, that's an elevated worksite related injury.
I don't
lifted it over my head because of the fence. Could have used a lull or could have used a hoist, but I used my hands and jumped up and tossed it over. That would be covered by this statute?
I don't believe so, Judge, because I don't believe that there is a statutorily required safety device for a toolbox because, once again, the size and the weight of the material that's being moved.
That is an ordinary risk inherent in construction work.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, yes, with regards to the toolbox hypothetical.
I think the danger is focusing too much on the elevated workplace. It's not just the elevated workplace. It's from an elevation differential that is what really the statute protects, isn't it? So someone could be standing on something only 3 inches high, but as long as something's hoisted over their head, the danger arises from the elevation differential. The workplace is defined as not only where the worker stands, but where the work's being conducted, where the hoisting's occurring. Isn't that the case?
I agree with that, Judge.
Oh, I thought it was called the scaffold law. Am I wrong about that? It's called the scaffold law, right?
It is referred to as the scaffold law, Judge, but the case law has evolved since the passing of the statute. I mean, if we look at the Runner case, we're not talking about a falling object. We're talking about the inherent effects of gravity on an object that was being...
pulled down four stairs.
Oh, yeah, four stairs. I mean, we're talking about the Walensky case where the plaintiff is standing on the same level as a piece of a rebar that falls down from... that's being stood straight up. We're talking about the Gutman case where a plaintiff and his workers, in the absence of a lull or heavy lifting device, lift up a beam from the ground, walk with it, and it drops and falls on plaintiff's foot. So it's evolved past just scaffolding. It's evolved past just falling workers and falling objects.
Well, the appellate, these fact patterns, you know, I thought that I was rid of Section 240 when I came to the federal bench, but it's taken 16 years for it to rise its ugly head once again. but I now feel like I'm back on Eagle Street trying to figure this thing out as we did when I was back there. The problem here is how is this an elevated related differential? I mean, it wasn't like that they were. I realize that you say they threw it up onto the truck, but they were. What if they had just slid it up onto the truck? I mean that wouldn't have been an elevated related differential, right? I mean, if it had stayed in contact with the truck, he wouldn't have a claim if somehow he was injured from that, would he?
I would disagree, and I think that it's a very dangerous proposition to hold workers to these specific nuances when the purpose of the activity, Judge, is to move a heavy object from one elevation to the
other. Well, let me ask you this. Watch this. Is that elevated differential work? What I just did?
Placing the cup on the...
Yeah, I raised it from the height. I realize I'm not making an endorsement of a product, but where Judge Loyer and I and Judge Sullivan have our computers and our other things, the work surface is below this, so I've raised it 6 inches, 8 inches. Is that elevated related work?
I believe it's...
Raising it?
I believe it is elevated work, raising it, because you are, in fact, moving an object, not a coffee cup, in this case a heavy object, from one elevation to the other. And I would cite also to the Gutierrez v. Lexington case, Judge. In the absence of a heavy lifting device, they created a simple machine. They created a ramp, a wooden ramp, that they were using their energy to push a spool of wire up the ramp when it fell onto the...
I'm just trying to understand what we should focus on. We shouldn't necessarily just focus on where the worker was standing. We should focus on the work that was being performed. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Judge. The purpose of the work that's being performed and what, if any, device is being replaced by the maneuver that they're using.
Now, just to move, because your client had to show two things. One was what we've been talking about. The other is proximate cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct? And for whatever reason, on this record, he appears to have forsaken the lull that was at least generally around, but had moved away. Is that right?
It wasn't in the general vicinity, Judge. It was not within eyesight, and it was at least 100 yards away.
But 100 yards away, but he could have waited.
No.
Even though there was some pressure from someone to get moving. Is that correct?
I don't believe there's anything on this record to say that he could wait, in terms of anyone that's testified to say, well, he wasn't really under a time crunch, or he could have waited. In his opinion, I mean, based upon the pressure that was being placed on his supervisor, the time constraints he was on, the fact that when he arrived, these pieces of metal are standing up straight in the roadway, and there's no lull that's available there, he knew that. On this record,
when you say no law that's available, you just said that it was 100 yards away.
But it wasn't available, Judge. It was being used.
So can you describe for me what you think New York law says about what readily available means? Is that a question of fact or a question of law?
Judge, I would actually argue that I would say it is a question of fact. And, you know...
What leads you to say that?
I mean, well, the case...
Have any of the cases described it as a question of fact?
Well, I think it is a factual determination because, you know, the one case we have to go off of in terms of availability is the Robinson case by the Court of Appeals. You know, the Robinson case, they found that, you know, where a plaintiff didn't seek out to see if equipment was being used or not, and just for no good reason decided to use a 6-foot ladder instead of an 8-foot ladder, even though he was told to use the right equipment, that, you know, it was available and he just decided not to use it. In this case, it does, readily available, I mean, he has to be able to use it within the time period by which he's asked to do this task. And he knows for a fact that there are only two lulls on this massive construction project, according to the record. One's being used way on the other side of the building, and it's being engaged, and he has no authority.
So in Robinson, he also testified that on prior occasions he had waited for a ladder to be freed up by other workers. So there was a time element.
Yes.
And that didn't really seem to make a difference. And it says, as a matter of law, these were the sole proximate causes of his injuries.
As a matter of law, the court found that he was the sole proximate cause of his injuries, yes.
So why isn't that the same issue here?
Because in Robinson, there was no proof on the record, and the court actually mentioned this, that he was under a time constraint, and that he could have just waited, or he could have moved on to another project. There's no evidence of that on the record in this case, Judge. I mean, the record evidence we have in front of us is our guy's being, he's in such a rush, he doesn't even finish unloading his own truck. He's in such a rush and that he's been told three different times by his supervisor, get this truck off the property.
Thank you.
Great, Judge.
We'll hear from Mr. Rossborough.
Good morning, may I please the court, Robert Rossborough on behalf of Apelli Global Foundries US Incorporated. To start with the proximate cause issue before your honors, the emergency situation that Mr. Jay claims caused him to use this manual lifting maneuver was one of his own making. His supervisor initially told him that he needed to get the worker off of the site by 3 p.m. so that the worker could get back to get off the clock for that's in the record, I believe at A148. The worker, the tougher driver himself, also told Mr. J, and that's in his deposition, Mr. J's deposition testimony, that this was just time for him to get off the clock. And Mr. J, in his affidavit in support of cross motion for summary judgment, says, if I'd waited for a lull, I would have been able to get him back there by 3:30. So you're looking at a 30-minute differential where Mr. J made a purposeful decision to not use an available safety device. And the Court of Appeals in Gallagher against New York Post actually has talked about what readily available means. It says liability under Section 240 doesn't attach when the safety devices that plaintiff alleges were absent were readily available at the worksite, albeit not in the immediate vicinity. And that's exactly this case. There, Mr. J admitted there were two lulls on site, one of which had just unloaded the tougher truck that he was driving to pick up these HVAC ducts. In that case, Mr. J could have waited 20 minutes, 25 minutes, still gotten the tougher driver back to the work site within a reasonable time after the deadline. No consequences would have occurred to Mr. J. His supervisor certainly didn't lay any out. And the only consequence would have been a little bit of overtime by the contractor. That trade-off is certainly one that the New York legislature has said needs to be made to promote worker safety. These safety devices are supposed to be on the worker site so that they are available. Yeah, so they can be available for these kinds of lifting techniques. Mr. J made the decision not to pursue that. But even if we accept that an emergency situation existed, then that forced him to use this manual lifting maneuver, there was no reason Mr. J needed to get into the back of the truck separately from using the lifting maneuver in the first place. That subsequent decision, after the first HVAC duct had been loaded, to get into the pathway where the duct was going to be loaded and place himself in harm's way, was the sole proximate cause of his injuries and destroys any proximate cause in this case.
What option was there? If he was going to not use the lull,
right?
They were trying to get this thing onto the truck,
right?
And they needed someone to be on the truck. No,
I don't believe so. There's no testimony to that effect in the record.
Well, he got the first one in without anybody in the truck.
Right. He got the first one in without anybody in the truck. And his concern, Mr. Jay testified, was that the second one might dent the first because it was a little bit shorter. But it was going back to, his testimony was, it was going back to the shop to be modified anyway. So again, the trade-off is where you can do this work, and if there's a dent in a piece of metal, it's better than having a substantial injury to a worker.
There are two proximate cause.
Two proximate cause issues, I think, in this case. The district court held on the gravity-related elevation harm, and I think that is supported in New York case law as well. There's multiple decisions of the appellate division that...
You mean that there's some ambiguity about this?
Certainly. There's ambiguity in every labor law 240
case.
I'm not as nearly versed
in New York law as my brother here.
Judge Wesley is rightly resident to see another 240 case in front of him.
The light of reason does not escape.
Absolutely. Every one of these cases has particular facts, and the law has not been applied clearly in every instance. But what it essentially has broken down to, from my reading of the law at least, is where you have, as here, workers who are intentionally propelling an object, or an object is launched by its own volition and then falls as a result of the kinetic energy. That's the energy that it generates because it was put into motion. The courts have held that is a mere incidental effect of gravity that isn't enough under the Court of Appeals case law to bring an injury under Section 240. There may be a different statute that applies. There may be ordinary negligence claim that applies, but it is not a special harm that 240 was supposed to protect against.
Well, in any event, this kinetic energy theory seems a little bit far afield to me, and the analysis to the rail that because of some tension within the rail, when the rail's piece of the rail is loose, then springs up and hits the worker. That seems most inappropriate to me. But let me ask you this:
sure.
Presume that these HVAC ducts had been 10 feet up in the air where they were ready to be installed, and they found that they didn't fit, and the workers decided to drop them into the back of the truck. Would that have been an elevated relation differential?
Sure, because at that point you have an object that the first application of force to it is gravity, pulls it down, falls into the back of the truck. When you have that force, that's the direct application of the force of gravity in that instance. In this case, you have
gravity.
Workers.
The thing just tipped over. Gravity would be what caused it to fall. So if in the course of hoisting it, it tipped over and landed on somebody's foot, that would be gravity that caused it, right?
In that case, sure, but it's in the incident. What the Court of Appeals case law is looking for is the direct application of gravity. It's gravity is the primary force that caused this. In this instance, that's not the case. In this instance, it was initially propelled by the workers intentionally to defeat gravity to get it back into the back of the truck.
In his example, it was the workers who used kinetic energy to get it off of the scaffold where it was into a truck. It seems to me that that's not going to work as the standard. The use of kinetic energy there's always going to be energy used to move something from one place to another, and once it's moved, gravity is going to make it tip over or fall.
Right. Well, the Court of Appeals has basically said is you look at the application of the force involved primarily, and the primary force that started the motion here was not gravity. It was the workers picking it up and flipping it into the back of the truck. In the application of Judge Wesley's hypothetical, you have the workers just dropping it. And then gravity is the primary force that acts. Those are two cases. And that's what the cases that the plaintiff relies on differentiates from what district court held below. The Gutierrez case, the Villanueva case, and the Gutman case that were cited in his reply brief, all were an object was dropped, whether it was being lifted by an inadequate safety device, like the rail hooks in Gutman, or if it was just dropped by workers lifting it up to the 9-foot elevated surface in Gutierrez. Each of those times, the force that acted on the object primarily was gravity because it was dropped and it fell. In this case, you have an intentional propulsion of an object to get it into the back of the truck when the plaintiff could have used a different decision had he waited.
All right, but so if they were just carrying this giant duct from here to here, required a couple of men to do it, and they dropped it 2 feet and it crushed somebody's foot.
Right.
That's gravity, and according to you, that's covered.
Well, that would be the force of gravity, but then you have the additional element, which is the falling because of a physically different elevation. And that's what's lacking in that example. And that if there's carrying it on the ground and the object was on the ground, then the court
lifted it and put it down.
Right. Well, the item
is you've got a lifting operation. I mean, this is these things that you just beat them around constantly. I always had a hard time trying to pin these things down, both at the AD and at the Court of Appeals. I mean, you do have an elevated. You have an elevation differential from where the duct is to where the duct's going to be. So you have an elevation differential. If you reversed it and they were taking it off the truck and putting it onto the ground, clearly if it had fallen off the truck and injured somebody, that would be a classic 240 case, wouldn't it?
It would.
Right. Yes, so then the question is it different because it's being lifted up onto the truck? Is the risk inherent because of a differentiation of elevation at the workplace? And is this materially different because it's coming from the ground up to the worker as opposed to coming from above the worker down to where the worker is? And you say that's different.
It is different. The Court of Appeals in Topher, which was a pre-runner case, the Court of Appeals distinguished in runner, said, when the item is flying upwards or horizontally at...
Runner is a doozer.
It certainly is.
Yeah, I wasn't there, so I can't...
When the Court of Appeals held in Topher that when an object was flying horizontally or upwards at a worker, that's not a 240 injury. And the Court of Appeals in Runner, when the court held that it was a 240 injury, specifically distinguished Runner on that ground, saying... Here you don't have the operation of gravity because the item is flying horizontally at the worker or sideways, or upwards.
Do you think that the easier course, given some of the ambiguities and some of the issues about New York law, is proximate cause?
It is, absolutely. It's far more clear in this instance where you have a worker who should have made two different decisions and unfortunately did not. I see my time is up. I would respect...
And we should make that decision here based on the record.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't send it back and let the judge decide.
Absolutely.
Your view
Absolutely.
Is that, well, this is an issue of proximate cause that can be resolved as a matter of law, not as a
right.
Matter of law.
And the district court below, you know, it can be resolved as a matter of law, and it should be here if you need to get that far. I would respectfully request that you affirm the district court order.
Thank you. Mr. Manley.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very quickly, I'm just going to go back to proximate cause. There's no evidence on this record that my client wouldn't have suffered consequences for not getting this truck off the site in the time period in which he was being asked to do it. There's no evidence on this record to say that, you know, he could have waited or that he didn't need to get this truck off. The fact is that my client is under an extreme amount of time pressure, and the only two laws that are available that are on the site are not available to him.
What about Gallagher?
I'm sorry?
About Gallagher. Gallagher.
Gallagher. Judge, it wasn't established in Gallagher that the plaintiff in that case knew where the safety devices were or knew that he was supposed to use them, right? So, my guy knows where they are, but he knows that he can't use them. He knows that they are being used.
But this was developed.
The thrust of this statute. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, this was argued below. The judge didn't rule on this, but this was part of the motion, right? Proximate cause?
Proximate cause was, it was kind of glossed over just because that, you know, there was this kinetic energy and gravity issue.
No, I know what the opinion was, but there was summary judgment, motion for summary judgment.
Yes, sir.
There's a record that's developed, and that's one of the arguments presented for granting summary judgment, right? That lack of proximate cause.
Yes, Judge.
And so the record is set. I mean, if whether the district court did or not, we could, I guess, just look at the record and say no fact finder could conclude that this injury was proximately caused by the lack of the lull. And if that were the case, there'd be no point in sending it back, right?
You could make that rule.
You think there's an issue of fact as to whether he was compelled to not use the lull, right?
Yeah, I think the issue of fact
that's the point you're trying to drive.
Yeah, that's the issue.
But there's there are two sets of issues. One is the timing, and then the second is he gets up there. He doesn't have to get up there. And it's to avoid a dent on another object. But the entire thrust of this law is to protect workers.
That's correct, Judge. Yeah, so I mean, him getting up into the truck, I would argue, that's contributory. He got up into the truck due to the lack of an available safety device. And he got up there to basically regulate the descent of this heavy piece of metal that would have been the job of a lull or a forklift had it been there and had it been available. He testified that if there was a lull available and he could use it, he would have used it for this task.
Absolutely.
This wasn't a case where he was told to use it or there was one sitting nearby and he was just like, you know what, screw it, I'm not going to use this thing. We're just going to put this thing on the truck. It's not that case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Reserved decision.
Journey home, gentlemen. Trip down memory lane. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
I think.